This is Seattle's Morning News. Legislature is getting to the big stuff now. Clean energy, protection from facial recognition software, and making it clear who actually pays for political ads. Here is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. So we're going to start with the clean energy bill here.
Yeah, so this was a big victory on Earth Day, I'll point out. That was yesterday. For Democrats and specifically for Governor Inslee, as the legislature passed his 100% clean energy bill. Senator Reuven Carlisle was really the driving force behind this in the legislature.
Climate change is the policy, the business, the financial, and in fact, the moral issue of our time. This comprehensive legislation is a bold and thoughtful and measured step forward to recognize that we can embrace deep decarbonization as a strategy in our electric sector and throughout our economy.
So this is a very complex bill, pretty complicated. What it really does is overhaul the state's energy production system. It will require electric utilities to meet certain energy standards over the next 25 years. They will have to ditch the use of coal power by 2025. All utilities will also be required to produce their own power from 100% clean energy sources by 2045, or they will face fines. The governor said it in a statement from Nevada yesterday. He's looking very forward to signing this bill that he says will fundamentally transform Washington's energy future.
Now, what counts as clean energy? Does nuclear energy count as clean energy?
Because
if it
sure.
doesn't, I'm told that this will, it's impossible to do.
And I believe that it does. I believe that it does.
Okay. What's next?
Another bill heading to the governor's desk would require more transparency from political action committees. So this one came from Democratic Representative Mike Pagliacciotti and is meant to make sure that you know who is actually bankrolling those political ads that come around during election time.
What it does is it makes it so that those who are sending out political ads can no longer use shell PACs or political action committees with friendly sounding names to hide who their true donors are. And it will require that the top donors to those PACs be listed on political ads.
So here's what the new rule will do if the governor signs it.
Right now, any political advertisement has to list its top five donors of that PAC that's mailing the or putting the TV on the ad. What this does is it says if there are any PACs listed in those top five donors, an additional line has to be added to identify the top donors to those political action committees who are not political action committees. The actual people or special interests that are not political action committees have to now be listed as the top donors to any PACs on the mailer.
So not only do the top five donors of the campaign have to be clearly revealed, if any of them are political action committees, then the top three contributors to those PACs must also be made clear, which is a significant change that Pagliacciotti hopes can give voters a much more clear picture.
What it does is it makes it so that special interests cannot create shell political action committees to hide who their true donors are, and it will expose the billionaires and other special interests who are funding our elections and make sure that voters see it when those ads come to them.
And he was pretty proud of this. He said this is a kind of puts Washington at the head of the pack as far as this kind of thing goes, mm-hmm. no pun intended, in transparency when it comes to who's bankrolling all of this. Another big one that is not going to make it to the governor this year is a controversial bill related to data privacy and facial recognition technology. It failed to get a vote last week before a deadline. Democratic Representative Zach Hudgens explains why.
I think it's been said over and over again, it's the wild, wild west when it comes to getting control of your data, knowing what kind of data companies have on you. And so I think we need to do some regulation. The bill that came over from the Senate, I thought, could be a lot better, a lot stronger, a lot more consumer-focused. And so that's where we started to run into trouble, is trying to make it a stronger bill, a better bill, more customer-focused, more based on consent and why the data was collected.
So one of the biggest, it cleared the Senate pretty strongly, and like he said there, he didn't feel it was strong enough by the time it got over to the House. And specifically, his concerns is it not the right people were being brought to the table to discuss this. I think mostly the tech companies, Microsoft, Amazon, Comcast was involved in the Washington Business Association. They ended up stripping this down, the bill, to just the title only to try to continue negotiations. They couldn't get anywhere on that. And one of the big sticking points is facial recognition.
There's a lot of studies out there. I think the biggest one is from MIT that showed facial recognition software is not perfect. And that imperfection shows bias. It shows discrimination. It shows that it doesn't identify, especially women with darker skin tones, very well. So I wasn't ready to allow a bad policy to get put in place that had that bias or that discrimination in the technology.
But he definitely wants to keep conversations going. I think there's some talk about maybe creating a work group or something in the interim and trying to get this done. Everyone involved has said they want to get this done next session. He just didn't think it was right. He didn't think it was strong enough, and it didn't get through the House.
So is there a, I mean, what would this look like? Would they be prohibited from using your image in any way? Or?
This would put in rules in place. So what law enforcement would have to do in order to use that type of facial recognition software? Uh-huh. There are other law enforcement agencies across the country who do use it. I don't think we're using it here in the state yet. And I asked him, I said, it sounds to me like this is something that the federal government should be in charge of putting all the regulations for. And he and everyone else involved in the discussion really say they really haven't done enough for that. And nobody wants to wait for Congress because they're slow.
really?
Was essentially the answer I got.
I had no idea. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Let's take you inside the halls of Congress with someone who knows how the sausage is made, Representative Derek Kilmer from our state's 6th District, covering Tacoma, the Olympic Peninsula, and the Kitsap Peninsula. He was on that conference call last night held by Speaker Pelosi. One of the things that she is trying to control, just how hard the Democratic Party will push for impeachment.
The tenor of the conversation was really focused on, let's take things one step at a time. Here's what we know. The Mueller report, even in its redacted form, has a lot that's really disturbing. We know from that report that a foreign government actively sought to influence Americans' elections. We know that, frankly, not enough has been done to keep that from happening again. We know that there were multiple incidents that are really deeply troubling, where the president engaged in actions that were not okay. And, you know, just because his aides refused his orders or failed to follow through doesn't make those actions ethical or okay. Having said that, the report, I think, leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And I think you'll see the committees with jurisdiction, including the Intelligence Committee and the Government Oversight Committee and the Judiciary Committee, really dig into some of those questions. I think we know enough to know that the findings of this report shouldn't be ignored. And I think we also know enough that it's important to sort of take things one at a time and be thoughtful about the approach ahead rather than rushing into to impeachment or any other action.
Well, I know you're not on the committees that would be involved in that, but you're saying that for you, you don't see impeachment as a priority that the Democratic Party should be involved in?
Well, here's what I think. I think that there is a lot of evidence of very concerning actions by the president. And unlike some of my colleagues across the aisle, I don't think we should ignore that. I don't think the American people should ignore that, and I don't think Congress should ignore that. Having said that, impeachment is, for good or for bad, a political exercise, and having not heard really any Republicans, maybe with the exception of Mitt Romney, voice any level of concern about the president's actions, having the House go through that exercise and having it be a dead end in the United States Senate, I'm not sure is a productive enterprise. Having said that, I don't think the Mueller report is something that should be swept under the carpet and ignored. So my sense is the committees of jurisdiction are going to be diving into some of the details and some of the unanswered questions from the report, and we'll see where things go from there. I think the Speaker has suggested let's take things one step at a time. I think that seems like a legitimate approach on something as grave as this.
Beyond the allegations about the president's own activity, the report made it clear that Russia is pretty determined to continue trying to interfere with our elections. Are you satisfied that enough has been done to secure the system for 2020?
Not at all. No. I think it's very clear that Russia executed very successfully a disinformation campaign targeting the American public, trying to sow discord, trying to undermine the American public's faith in the democratic process, and ultimately to interfere in the 2016 election. And I don't think enough has been done. We've seen some positive steps forward. H.R. 1, which I think we talked about a month or so ago, tries to take some steps to protect the integrity of the American election system, including incorporating one of my bills called the Honest Ads Act that says, let's make sure that online political activities have the same disclosure requirements as TV and radio advertisements. That's important in part because we've seen more and more political spending go into the online domain, but it's also important because we saw foreign actors actually spend money on online political ads trying to influence our election. Right now, there is no disclosure requirement, and as a consequence, not really much in the way of being able to prevent foreign actors. I think a lot more needs to be done with regard to cybersecurity and protecting actually our election systems. So, you know, the short answer is no, not enough has been done. And my hope is that Congress takes that threat very seriously. And I don't say that as a Democrat. I say that as an American who wants to protect the integrity of our election system.
Congressman Derek Kilmer representing the 6th Congressional District. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross, Colleen O'Brien. We're getting ready for the 2020 census, and as you know, it's embroiled in controversy because the Trump administration wants to add a citizenship question. You would have to answer whether or not you are a U.S. citizen. A number of people are worried about that, including Robert Chang, who is executive director of the Korematsu Center and a professor of law, and Sharon Sakamoto, who, along with her two sisters, spent World War II incarcerated in the Minidoka camp in Idaho when President Roosevelt decided that Japanese Americans, who were citizens, could not be allowed to fraternize with the rest of the American public. So, Robert, you have filed an amicus brief on this case. Census information is supposed to be anonymized, right? So it can't be traced back to the person who answers. So why would it be wrong to ask a citizenship question?
So in theory, the information is anonymized, and there are certain protections, but we've seen in the past that those protections have not held up. Specifically, during World War II, the census provided information that facilitated the rounding up of Japanese Americans. Given the current political climate, asking the citizenship question under these circumstances is very troubling.
So how was it used in World War II? Which question did they use to identify where Japanese Americans lived, since they're already citizens?
The census kept track of where Japanese Americans lived by neighborhood. And in addition to counting or figuring out where Japanese Americans lived, part of the information that was crucial and that was used by the military and by the U.S. government was the large number of Japanese Americans who were not citizens. Now, part of the problem with that is that Japanese Americans who immigrated to the United States could not become U.S. citizens. And so the issue of citizenship is one that is deeply concerning to members of the Japanese American community.
Sharon, you were actually born at the Minidoka camp?
I was, Dave.
This is in this was in Idaho?
Yes.
But you were first taken to the Puyallup Fairgrounds, I believe,
correct,
right?
And correct.
So when did you become aware of the significance of your birthplace?
I was the only one not born in Seattle, mm-hmm, of my family. I'm the youngest. And all through my years growing up, people would talk about before the war and after the war. Most of my siblings remembered before the war, and I couldn't. No. I wanted to, and used to tell them, oh, I remember before the war, but I was very aware that I was born in Idaho and my siblings were born in Seattle.
Were you angry growing up? Angry at Roosevelt? Or?
I think it was not anger as much as recognition of the great unfairness. Great unfairness.
Yeah. So you have joined this this case.
Absolutely.
And so tell me why. Why go to all the trouble?
Because since that time, I have become aware, very aware of the breach of confidentiality by the Census Bureau in identifying and locating people of my background and community. There was that breach, that clear breach. It's admitted by the Census Bureau, admitted by General DeWitt, and I want to be watchful. I think our government has to be accountable.
One of the most important things that happens after the decennial census is that state legislatures decide how to create each legislative district. this information becomes a tool that would actually be used to change the way that representation works, and also it's going to change the way that funding operates. So do we change the way that we fund our roads, fund our schools, based on this information? It's about the electoral map.
I thought districts were drawn based on number of people, not the number of citizens.
There's a recent case, Evanwell versus Abbott, that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and there were individuals who claimed that only voting eligible, so the voting eligible population should be the basis for districting. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. Supreme Court said that that's not required, but state legislatures actually have the ability to change how they count.
I didn't know that.
Is precisely then why this information might be being sought.
So a state, so each state could decide for itself how to count people in a district, and they could decide that if you're not a citizen, you don't count towards the population requirements of a district?
So my understanding is that the U.S. Supreme Court left it as an open question.
So essentially, if a state decided to use this, they would end up undercounting, and they'd get fewer representatives in Congress. Why would they do that?
Well, it depends on what state you're talking about. What we find is that with changing immigration patterns, you have certain portions of red states turning purple, or mm-hmm. in some instances, blue. So if a red state where the control of the legislature is among those who would want to decrease the political power of urban areas that have larger non-citizen populations.
So this would be in-state elections where this could manifest itself, then.
Sure, but it has repercussions nationally.
What's been the federal government's counter-argument to yours?
One of the primary arguments that the Department of Justice has put forward is that this is simply within the discretion of the Department of Commerce. So if the Secretary Wilbur Ross says, I want to have this question, mm-hmm. that it's not something that the courts can even question. You know, they're saying things like, you can't even ask Wilbur Ross what he was thinking. You can't question his motives. And to me, that's a very frightening prospect. It's the danger of tyranny.
You're also arguing, I believe, that just having the question on there would discourage people from filling it out at all. Sharon, do you think this would discourage people from filling out the census form?
Well, I think we have to look at our history, which is a misuse of census data. So, yes, I think it's this public trust that is going to deeply be affected by adding the citizenship question. It has not been on the census questionnaire for, I think, over 50 years, and all of a sudden they bring this up kind of out of thin air and expect that people are going to trust that effort.
So the most extreme example of the breach of trust and confidentiality that took place during World War II was that the names and addresses of 90-some-odd Japanese-Americans living in the Washington, D.C. area were provided based on information that was gleaned from the census, and it was given to government officials. And it was made possible because even though prior to that, there were laws regarding confidentiality and the census, the Second War Powers Act during World War II permitted the information to be obtained from the census.
So the people who filled out the forms back then had also been promised it would be anonymous, but that was apparently overruled pretty easily. So you really do have a concern that that national security could be invoked again to strip the anonymity from this kind of information.
That is a concern.
Robert Chang is executive director of the Korematsu Center and professor of law, and is participating in the amicus brief on this census case. And Sharon Sakamoto was born in Camp Minidoka. Nice to meet you both. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the Supreme Court will be hearing extended arguments on this case today.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Finding the goodness happening all around us is the specialty of Carol Evans Boyd Hubert, and he's done it again in the halls of the University of Minnesota's Masonic Children's Hospital.
What's up, buddy?
Good.
Where my hug at? Come on now.
4-year-old Cooper has a best friend in Gregory Watson, a janitor at the hospital who just last year had been assigned to the fifth floor, and that's where Cooper is a lot due to a genetic condition he was born with. Gregory loves working around children, but he never expected to form the kind of bond he has with Cooper. It all started with popcorn.
We can have some popcorn.
Yeah.
You want some?
Yeah. Popcorn. I want 2 bags today.
Please.
Good. And then who's the other bag for?
For Gregory.
For Gregory, of course. On the day Boyd observed their friendship, it had been a few weeks since Cooper's last hospital visit. But Cooper doesn't need an appointment to visit his friend. In fact, his mom says,
for his potty chart, be like 5 stickers and then you get a prize. One time he said that he wanted his prize to be to go to the hospital.
Some little boys like to dress up as superheroes. Cooper told his mom, he's Gregory. She says their floors are very clean.
Mommy, the floors.
You almost done?
No, I want more popcorn. He was my best friend.
And what's incredible is with the genetic disorder he has, don't ask me what it is or how to pronounce it, but his body needs more salt intake. And mm-hmm. so it so happens that this friendship over popcorn is actually a health benefit for Cooper as well. So it works out in more than one way.
Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Russell Wilson sharing the wealth. Now, let's not look a gift horse in the mouth, but how much did he get?
12,000. Oh, how much he got?
How much he got?
$65 million signing bonus.
I can't believe you're doing this.
And how much did he give to the people who defend him?
$12,000 of Amazon stock apiece. So a total of about $156,000.
Okay. That's generous.
With the potential to, I mean, look at how much Amazon has grown.
Well, the idea
is. Are you just jelly you don't have Amazon stock?
Ooh. Are you jelly?
Possibly.
Dave? Are you jelly?
Possibly.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. I mean,
it's a statement that he made that you've invested in my future by protecting me. I'm investing in your future by giving you. It's a nice gesture. If you had a $12,000 gift from someone, you'd feel pretty appreciative.
It's a nice gesture.
And the 12 is symbolic.
Right.
12th man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Get it?
You could add another zero out of that.
But it's not about.
It's not about the money. That's right. Sorry.
Well, no, I wasn't going to say that. It's not about, like, at what point would it be fair compensation? They work, they get wages for their living as well.
Yeah.
It is typical for running backs and quarterbacks to give offensive linemen gifts.
Oh, really?
Going back to Dan Marino and his isotoners.
Oh.
You remember the glove commercials that Dan Marino had?
Sure.
He had isotoner gloves, and he would give isotoner gloves to his linemen They protected him. He was in their hands, and so he wanted to protect their hands.
So what would you rather have, gloves or $12,000 in Amazon stock?
Yeah.
A little different perspective now, huh?
Yeah, I guess so.
There have been different things. I think it's interesting that he picked Amazon, and I wondered, is he trying to angle for a sponsorship there?
Mm.
It was Alibaba.
Well, remember when he posted that picture on his Instagram? He was making pancakes with Jeff Bezos. Wasn't that Jeff Bezos?
You're right.
Yeah,
he was making pancakes. So that's what I wondered. If there was a marketing opportunity that young Russ, the businessman, was taking advantage of here, which I would have been impressed with. I know that Watchwinders, when you're the quarterback for the Seahawks, got his offensive lineman something to wind their luxury watches, which... I was unfamiliar with that being a necessity.
Why would a luxury watch even need to be wound?
Well, because the motion of wearing some of the nicer watches, Rolexes, I guess, is what actually winds the watch. So if you don't wear the watch, it will eventually be out of strength. You need something that will keep it in motion so it stays wound.
Pay that much for a Rolex? It's got to be wound? That's crazy. This watch cost me $29.95. It's lasted for 12 years, has solar power, never have to wind it, perfect atomic time.
Really?
That's true. It beeps at the top of every hour.
Well, that gift would be wasted on you, Dave.
Yes, it would.
Don't give Dave a Rolex or $12,000 in Amazon stock.
Or a watch winder.
He is unimpressed by your gifts.
That's exactly right. I like that piece that Shannon Dreher wrote about the Mariners clubhouse spirit.
Yeah. They're getting excited. Yeah. They got Yusei Kikuchi that's there. You're trying to bond with the new group of players. He's been embraced. They're showing him around. They've got a motto this year, Kaizen.
Huh?
Which, yeah, it's a Japanese corporate motto, Kaizen, which means everyone always seeking improvement.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, Kaizen, it's their motto.
Well, it's working so far.
It is. They still got the best record in the league.
That's crazy.
Because they didn't play yesterday.
Yeah.
They held on to it.
So who's next?
Who's next? They're going to play the San Diego Padres. They're our natural rival.
Why?
because we needed a natural rival in the National League.
Okay.
Oakland has San Francisco.
The Padres.
The Angels have Anaheim. We're on the West Coast.
I was unaware of this rivalry.
We're fighting over the allegiance of Eddie Vedder, who is from San Diego. We don't like the Blue Jays. We don't like them coming down from Canada.
Right, and that's why I thought they'd be a rival.
That's our rival. But Major League Baseball pairs you with a natural rival in the National League.
Oh.
And that was made...
So this was predestined.
Oh, yeah. It's completely artificial.
Not a rivalry.
Yeah, no, it's not. Although I've thought about, like, should we get something fired up with San Diego? People in San Diego live in too nice a place to be really mad about anything. You can't have a rivalry when you're living in San Diego.
And we sort of have the same problems, too, right? No, I'm thinking San Francisco. San Diego's different.
San Diego
is all beach and waves and fish tacos. Yeah.
And it's really, really nice. Yeah. And people down there really like it. It's hard to be tough when you wear flip-flops every day. That's difficult.
Well, that's something we can pick on.
Yeah, exactly.
They'll pick on our Birkenstocks.
Major League Baseball chooses rivals. I didn't know that.
They pair you with a National League team and say this is your natural rival, and you'll play that team every year. It works in cities where there are two, like I said, Oakland and San Francisco. Yeah, yeah. The Angels of Anaheim and the LA Dodgers, that's pretty natural. The Rangers and the Astros, like, these are natural rivalries.
It's not working for me.
Seattle and San Diego, there's not much. Eddie Vedder was from San Diego, but he lives here, so we could stick it to them that way. He left and came up here and made Pearl Jam, suckers.
I just feel so manipulated. One more thing. The CBS has signed to a broadcast WNBA teams.
Yes, they have.
Is that a breakthrough?
It is. It's a significant step forward in the Seattle Storm, who've unfortunately suffered a huge setback. Their best player got hurt.
Brianna Stewart.
Playing in Russia, the reigning league MVP, which has brought up questions of, look, WNBA players play overseas because they need it to augment the salaries that they make here. And is that a reflection of a lack of appetite for women's basketball here, or is that we don't value it enough? But the fact that they do have a national TV contract with CBS, and there's going to be 6 Storm games that are carried, that is a step forward. It's significant.
And we'll be able to move the mark, I think, because it's always the chicken or egg thing. What comes first? Do you televise them and then see if they're popular, or do you just say they're not popular enough to televise? Now that we will televise them, we can actually see what the audience appetite is.
And they've been on TV before, but it's been harder to find consistent coverage. This is a national TV. Yes, I think that you should be able to. It should be a better environment for monitoring not just the ratings, but the potential growth of ratings.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thanks, Danny.
You bet.
Joining us now from the Washington Post, as he does each Tuesday, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold. And David, you're writing today about the president suing to block this congressional subpoena of his financial records. What exactly, which records are these? What is Congress looking for, David?
In this case, Congress has asked Trump's accountant to provide them with a bunch of records that basically Trump provided to the accountants over the years, so the accountants could compile these things called statements of financial condition. Basically, I think we talked about these a few weeks ago. They're sort of sales brochures for Trump, in which he would try to convince lenders that he had a lot of money and was a good credit risk. But those statements contained a lot of exaggerations. They left out key facts. They also had just misstated some key numbers. Congress is trying to learn more about them, and Trump is saying that this accountant shouldn't give this data up.
Now, what you cited a certain Supreme Court ruling that they are trying to use to say the president doesn't have to abide by this?
Yeah, so a little bit of the backstory. Trump's argument is that Congress should only be able to investigate things that it is planning to legislate on. If it doesn't have like a bill ready to go, or it's not working on a bill, that it doesn't have the power to just investigate whatever it wants. And it cited, Trump in his legal brief, cited a Supreme Court decision from 1880 that made that argument. Like, if Congress isn't going to write a bill about this, then it doesn't have the power to investigate. The problem is that decision from 1880 was invalidated in 1927 by a separate Supreme Court decision and hasn't been the law of the land for 90 years. Supreme Court in 1927 said basically Congress has the power to investigate whatever it wants as long as it may someday produce legislation or just helps with oversight of the presidency. So Trump's argument basically hasn't been good law since the Warren Harding administration.
I see. I saw you get a little pushback on that, though, on Twitter from a lawyer who said, no, that is a perfectly legitimate Supreme Court decision.
Well, it was a Supreme Court decision, and I am no constitutional scholar, but what our legal experts told us yesterday was it's not really the law anymore.
Yeah.
Of course, Congress can legislate anything, as you point out. Maybe they want this to put together an independent counsel bill so that the president can't tell them what to do anymore. In any case, the whole Mueller thing was supposed to be an ending. It turns out to be a beginning, and now they're talking about bringing in Don McGahn, the president's former White House counsel, to talk about some of the sessions he witnessed where the president ordered him to do things that would have constituted obstruction of justice. I assume that there's no impediment to him testifying, correct?
He talked to Mueller, and his comments to Mueller have been out there. So the White House has been fighting every piece of this, but he doesn't work for them anymore. There doesn't seem to me to be any legal reason that McGahn couldn't talk about kind of the things that have already been out.
Now, the other thing that's come up, and this was an editorial carried by your newspaper, essentially saying Trump should be impeached, not because of what's in the Mueller report, but because of a completely different issue, this merger between Time Warner, parent company of CNN, and AT&T, which the president sought to block. Can you explain that issue to us?
U.S. government has powers, antitrust powers, to block or challenge proposed mergers, but they're only supposed to be used for the public's protection, right? These are things that they use these powers to make sure that power isn't concentrated with one company, that consumers don't lose choice and have to pay more. You're not supposed to use it as acts of personal revenge against people you don't like. And Trump has sought to intervene, reportedly, in this debate to block it because he doesn't like CNN, which is owned by Time Warner, and he wants to do something to sort of screw CNN over. That's not the reason you're supposed to block mergers, and so yes, there's been some push to like punish Trump over that or investigate him over that.
But now you say, do we know that he did this to punish CNN?
There's been some reporting on this. I don't think he's ever said it out in the open, but there's been some reporting that that's his reason for wanting to block it. He hates CNN.
Now, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, held a conference call last night trying to defuse this whole push for impeachment, but it's clear that there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who want to move ahead with this. Is it your feeling that this is actually going to go ahead?
I think Pelosi's strategy is most likely, because she has all the power, is most likely going to be what happens, which is that Pelosi has said, let's investigate, let's look into the things that Trump has done that are laid out in the Mueller report, but let's not at this point file articles of impeachment. And I don't even really think Pelosi wants to ever have impeachment. She sees this as, let's use this to defeat Trump at the ballot box in 2020 rather than try to remove him from office. I think she feels like impeachment would never really be removed because the Senate wouldn't back him up, and it would seem to people like an overreach that they should try to get the best political benefit out of the investigation without the overreach of trying to impeach him.
Now, from the other side, we've heard the Republicans talking openly about launching an investigation into how the FBI investigation into Trump got started and into this allegation, which came up when Robert Barr, the Attorney General, William Barr, the Attorney General, was testifying, that there was spying going on against the Trump campaign. How serious is that?
It seems to be more serious than I thought. Obviously the Senate doesn't seem very interested in this. The House is controlled by Democrats. If this was going to be done, it would be done by the Justice Department, which has not happened in the last 2 years of Trump's control. Barr, however, seems to be willing to do things that Jeff Sessions would not. And so Barr has talked in a very vague sort of way about spying or trying to learn the origins of the FBI probe into President Trump's campaign. We don't really know what he's doing. Obviously, Trump himself has pushed for this and said many times, now we have to investigate the investigators, punish the people that started this, which is a dangerous way for the president to talk about using law enforcement. But I don't really know how far Barr is going to push it.
Well, what do we know about the origins of the campaign? About the origins of the investigation into the campaign?
Well, we know it began in 2016, relatively early. I'm not the person who's covered the ins and outs of this, but there was certainly a counterintelligence investigation by the FBI to try to figure out what is Russia doing here. Is Russia trying to influence Trump? That investigation sort of folded into the Mueller investigation, and I think we don't really know what the counterintelligence piece of results of that was. Mueller's report only covered sort of did Trump break the law, not is Trump a security risk.
But I mean, the feeling among Trump supporters is that this began because of that Steele dossier, which made all these outrageous allegations about what happened in a hotel room, and that essentially, if you base an investigation on a, I guess it's not been entirely discredited, but parts of it are certainly sketchy, then whatever flows from that is improper.
You're right, that there's an sense that the dossier began this, and it did not. It seems like the investigation of what was going on with Trump, what was happening with his advisors and their connections to Russia, from what we've seen, predated the dossier.
I see. So it was people like, what was it, Carter Page and Manafort who were on the FBI's radar before this dossier came out?
Particularly Page. I mean, remember, Manafort didn't join the campaign until relatively late, but people like Carter Page, who Trump has announced as an advisor, that was somebody that the FBI was very concerned about, his connections to Russia. This guy, George Papadopoulos, who also was listed as a Trump advisor. You know, it seems like they were worried and in the beginning of 2016 that maybe there was some compromise of Trump, and they started trying to look into it, or compromise the people around him. But it wasn't the dossier that began it.
Okay, one more thing. Your own emoluments investigation, where does that stand?
We are, plugging ahead. There's just this last week, the ambassador of Australia and the ambassador from Mongolia appeared at Trump properties in Florida. So one thing we've seen recently is a lot of folks using Mar-a-Lago, which has sort of shifted its business model from handling the Palm Beach elite to basically handling anybody with $20 who wants to walk in the door, that more foreign leaders and ambassadors are using that as a way to get to Trump. So we're certainly still working on that subject.
So you think this is still worth pursuing? The people are from other countries are deliberately spending money at Trump properties as a way to sidle up to him.
I think that is right. I mean, and not only to, you know, as a way to influence him, but also as just a way to meet him. You know, if you get in front of him, you can change his mind on something. Just last weekend, the American-Turkish Business Council had a big meeting at the Trump Hotel in D.C., I think the third year in a row, which brought a huge number of Turkish diplomats, army officers, other folks to the president's hotel. Certainly people see this as a way to influence him, and I think in ways that we're just beginning to understand, they're succeeding.
David Farenthold from The Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Choke points. Would you spend 5 minutes to ensure that you don't kill someone on the road today? I think all of us would probably say yes to that. So why don't more people secure their loads before driving away? Chris Sullivan's been looking into that. Chris?
Yeah, two people have been killed on Washington roads in the last 5 years in collisions caused by flying debris. More than 80 others have been injured in the 800 total unsecured load crashes in those 5 years. Chris Loftus with the Washington State Patrol says the public has to change its behavior.
It's a choice that people make to not secure their load, so it's also a choice to do the right thing and secure it. These are extraordinarily preventable injuries, extraordinarily preventable deaths.
And Loftus says the law is clear. You must tie your stuff down. And in many cases, you have to tarp it or net it to make sure that nothing flies out.
I know it takes a few minutes, and whether it's the load going to the dump or whether it's the kayaks going to the lake, if you're putting it on your vehicle, you're responsible for it. You're responsible for the people behind you. You're responsible for their lives. You're responsible for their safety. You're responsible for the road.
Fines for littering can run between $50 and $5,000. Of course, the littering fines, when you have something lit that's thrown out the window, that's where they really go up. But, you know, we're talking more about the securing of full loads. And, you know, you could face criminal charges if something flies off your car or out of the back of your truck bed and injures somebody. And Loftus says the State Patrol pulls over more than 6,400 vehicles a year for this infraction.
When you're seeing and pulling 6,400 people over, that means there's many more thousands that are not being seen and are not being pulled over. And it all adds up to, like, say, over 12 million pounds of debris.
That's 12 million pounds of debris taken off of Washington's highways and freeways just last year. That's a yearly number. That costs the state about $4 million to clean up. That's why troopers are running a 28-day emphasis patrol across the state right now to target unsecured loads. Loftus says it's your responsibility.
We've lost two people in the state in the last 5 years just for something so preventable as just simply securing what you're pulling, what you're hauling, and what you're carrying.
Now, I get a lot of questions about commercial haulers and whether they have to abide by this. And the short answer is yes. It doesn't matter who is carrying the load. But here's where we kind of get into a gray area. According to state law, any vehicle carrying dirt, sand, or gravel must be covered. But if those vehicles have 6 inches of freeboard maintained within the bed, they don't have to cover them. That's why you see the dump trucks out there with, like, that 6-inch piece of wood at the very top of the sides of their vehicle.
Right.
That allows them to get around this covering provision. And I'm not sure what they base that on, but I mean, I get a lot of, they're like, people see those in those loads.
Yeah.
And what really gets, I mean, I got an email just the other day that said, I see dump trucks that have a cover on them, or one of those, but
right.
but it's not in use. And the way they get away with that is that they had that little piece of wood there along the side of there, and that apparently counts as good enough as long as they load the vehicle properly. And I know that rubs some people the wrong way. The other thing important in this is, what do you do if your car is damaged? Say, for instance, you're behind a truck like that and you gravel or rocks hit you, or you're behind somebody and their tent flies out of the back of their umbrella or whatever. You know, it's really hard to go after the other driver unless you have great proof of where that debris came from. So a dash cam is really good for this. In most cases, you write down as much info as you can, you know, where you were, the time of day, type of vehicle, any markings, a plate number. You file a claim and let your insurance figure it out.
I either just try to pass them or stay way behind, and somebody will fill in the space, and then, you know, they'll be the point person. But, yeah, the uncovered trucks, I don't really get why that's allowed.
Yeah, and I don't either, especially, and I don't mean to harp on the commercial side, but they're obviously, you see them much more often than you would see, you know, mom and pop carrying their trailer. Though I got to admit, a couple of days ago on the I-5 corridor, I did see this emphasis at work. There was a truck hauling a short flatbed trailer, obviously on their way to the dump, and it wasn't covered, and had a little state trooper behind him. I think he was having a talking to and perhaps getting a ticket during this emphasis patrol. But yeah, I think a lot more people get upset about seeing the bigger trucks, you know, kicking out stuff, and they're wondering why just a little piece of wood along the side of the bed counts when everybody else has to cover their load.
Cairo traffic coach Chris Sullivan.